Hello, true crime lovers. I'm Julia, and this is always time for true crime. This week's episode is coming to you a little bit late, so I do apologize, but I think you'll find that it's worth the wait. Today's case is about two little girls who in 2008 were best friends. 11-year-old Skyla and 13-year-old Taylor were an inseparable pair. But on a weekend sleepover, that was supposed to be an amazing start to the summer, their innocence was taken from them in a brutal murder. It took 3 years and another victim to finally reveal who was responsible for these cold-blooded killings. And even now, 12 years later, there remains questions about what happened that Sunday afternoon in June 2008. In June 2008, in the small town of Waleka, Oklahoma, 11-year-old Skyla Whitaker and 13-year-old Taylor Placker were excited to finish up the school year in the next few weeks and start summer vacation. It was going to be their second summer to spend together, as the two had met at the beginning of the last school year, bonding over the fact that they were both new kids to the school. In 2006, Skyla's family, the Whitakers, had moved to Oklahoma from Kansas, and Taylor had just started going to school after being homeschooled for all of her life. The girls first met when they both made it onto the cheerleading squad, and quickly became joined at the hip. The next year, they were so excited to be put into the same class, because even though Skyla was 2 years younger, she was only one grade younger. And that year, the two had been put in a grade 5-6 split class. And even with the 2-year age gap between the two, Skyla and Taylor got along perfectly. Skyla was a bubbly, lively, athletic girl who was always smiling and cracking jokes. Her parents said that she loved animals and wanted to be a veterinarian when she grew up. She even had her own dogs, cats, and a pet goat. Skyla lived with her mother, Rose, her stepfather, and a bunch of step-siblings. Taylor was a little bit more on the shyer side. Like I said, she had been homeschooled most of her life, so when she got to real school, she was a bit intimidated and had a hard time making friends. But Skyla was able to help her come out of her shell a little bit. Taylor was also very smart and actually wanted to be a forensic scientist when she was older. So it sounds like she would have been a true crime lover. Taylor lived with her maternal grandparents, Pete and Vicky Placker, her mom, Jennifer, and her aunt, Linda. However, Taylor's family setup was a bit different than most. She saw her aunt, Linda, and her biological mom, Jennifer, more as big sisters, and called her grandparents Ma and Pa. So you'll see in a lot of articles, sometimes Pete and Vicky Placker are referred to as Taylor's parents, though they're actually her grandparents. That being said, Taylor did know that Jennifer was her biological mother, and Jennifer was still very active in her daughter's life. It just seemed like Jennifer was quite young, so Pete and Vicky had stepped in to help raise Taylor. On Friday, June 6, 2008, Rose Whitaker dropped Skyla off at Taylor's house for a sleepover. Skyla's parents were going away for a night, and since there was nobody to look after her, she got to stay the night at Taylor's, which was obviously not a problem for the girls. On Saturday, Skyla and Taylor spent almost the whole day down by Bad Creek Bridge looking for turtles. Taylor actually lived just outside of Waleka on this rural county road, so it was a little bit more of a private area. And Bad Creek Bridge was only a few minute walk from the Placker house, so the girls would always be out there playing down by the water. When they got back from a day out playing at the bridge, Skyla and Taylor were excited to hear that Rose had called and asked if Skyla could stay another night, as she and her husband wouldn't be home until Sunday. And this part gave me such a nostalgic feeling because I can literally remember the sheer excitement and happiness when you got permission to stay longer at your friend's house. That Saturday night, the girls attempted to pull an all-nighter, and were actually pretty successful, Because when Taylor's Aunt Linda woke up the next morning to go to work, Skyla and Taylor were still up, chatting on her bed. They then finally fell asleep around 9 a.m. Sunday morning and slept until late afternoon. When they woke up around 4 p.m. or 4:30, Taylor's grandma told them to get dressed and ready because Skyla's mom would be picking her up soon. But Taylor and Skyla said they wanted to go see the turtles just one more time before Skyla left. Originally, Grandma Vicky said no, but after the girls begged, she gave in. She told them to be back soon, though, because she wanted Skyla to be ready when her mom came. And with that, the girls ran off to the creek. Just after 5 p.m., so almost an hour later, Skyla's mom called the house to tell them that she was on her way to pick up her daughter. But Vicky realized the two girls hadn't come back from the creek. Taylor had a cell phone that she was supposed to take with her for emergencies, so Vicky called her phone. But Taylor didn't pick up. Assuming that Taylor probably didn't hear the phone or maybe she had it on silent, Grandma Vicky then asked her husband Pete to go get the girls himself. After all, the creek wasn't really too far away. So Pete starts walking down the country road calling the girls' names. Finally, he reaches the road near the creek and sees the two girls lying on the ground at the side of the road. He might have thought that they were just playing or something, but when he approaches them, he notices that they are both covered in blood. Pete runs back to the house as fast as he can and tells Vicky to call 911.
I'm on Kennedy 911 emergency.
Yes, somebody killed two girls over my daughter, my grandbaby, and
my
her daughter, a friend. I'm on Kennedy Road.
What happened now, ma'am?
I don't know. They went for a walk and they're both dead.
Their daughter dead?
They're dead.
Your granddaughter?
Yes, and my her friend.
Okay, where's this at, ma'am? Stay calm.
I'm on County Line Road.
Which county line?
Off Bryant Road.
Off Bryant Road?
Yes. Going toward Coleman Road. Oh, my God. I don't know. Help me, please.
Okay, ma'am. I need you to stay calm so we can get out there to you, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Let me pull up my map and try to find out where you're at.
Route 1, block 185.
Okay, we can't look them up at the routes. Okay,
oh, please. Don't help me, please.
Okay, just stay on the line with me.
Police are quick to arrive on scene and determine the two girls have been shot multiple times in the head and chest. Taylor was shot 5 times, Skyla 8 times. Sheriff Darrell Summers remembers that the young girls' bodies were posed in a sexual nature. Taylor's feet were touching and her legs spread open in a diamond shape. A number of shell casings were found at the scene, from a .40 caliber pistol. There was also gunpowder on Taylor's face, meaning the gun was only inches away from her when she was shot. The crime scene and girls' bodies are examined for DNA and fingerprints, while their underwear is also sent to the crime lab. At the autopsy, it was determined that not all 13 bullets were from the .40 caliber pistol. Some were from a .22. And since no .22 caliber shell casings were found at the scene, investigators guessed that these were probably from a revolver. So now they had two different weapons, which probably meant two different killers. Also at the autopsy, the ME realized that Taylor had been shot under her shorts. She had a bullet wound on her upper thigh, almost in her genital area. The weird thing, though, was that there was no bullet hole in her shorts, which meant Taylor's shorts were either pulled up or down when she was shot. Wounds on Taylor's face also showed that she had been hit in the face with the butt of the gun. But that wasn't all. The lab confirmed that semen was found on the two girls' underwear. However, the ME found no evidence of sexual trauma to the girls, and detectives say the girls were not sexually assaulted. Right away, that strikes me as weird. I mean, it's possible the killer masturbated at the scene, but didn't sexually assault the girls, but still, it's a bit off, right? And we're going to come back to this later, so don't worry. The police immediately began looking for leads and put out a reward to help catch the person or persons who murdered these girls. It was known that Bad Creek was a popular spot for local teens to practice their target shooting. It was clear that this wasn't an accidental shooting, like the girls hadn't accidentally gotten hit by a stray bullet. But still, if these teens had access to guns, it was worth checking out. Many residents of Waleka had called police, telling them the names of teenagers who were known to target shoot down by the creek. These teenage boys were brought in for questioning, but were quickly ruled out, as the only guns they did target shoot with were rifles. With no further leads, investigators began working on a profile. They strongly believed that the man or men who did this were local, as like I said, this was a pretty desolate country road. Skyla's father, William, agreed. Quote, "There's absolutely no way that someone from out of the area could have just stumbled upon this place." End quote. Police suggested that maybe the girls had seen something they shouldn't have, and maybe someone had killed them to keep them quiet. But then they got another tip. A neighbor called in and told police she had seen a Native American man driving down the country road that day. She said this stuck out because only locals drove that road and she didn't know him. While this was definitely considered a credible lead by law enforcement, people on the internet theorized that it might have had a racist motive behind it, like just trying to blame a Native American. Police did release a sketch of this Native American man who was supposedly seen that day, but no probable leads ever emerged from it. Funeral services were held for the girls on June 13th. Skyla was then cremated, while Taylor was buried in a local cemetery. A memorial of crosses, teddy bears, and pictures was also set up where the girls' bodies were found. Unfortunately, though, a month after the murders, the memorial was vandalized, and a message was left that read, quote, "You'll never catch me," end quote. Investigators didn't know whether this was real or just a joke, but they assured the media that they would catch who was responsible. Then, 2 months after the murders, investigators announced that they had 3 suspects. The first was 30-year-old Tony Kilo. Tony came into question earlier in the summer when someone called in saying that they had seen Tony the night of the murders, and he had blood-like stains on his overalls. When police went to follow this up, Tony said that it wasn't blood on his clothes. It was a wood stainer, as he had been doing some woodworking in the yard that day. Either way, police told the media that he was a suspect. Tony adamantly denied killing the girls. He even told police that he had an alibi, which his girlfriend later confirmed. But it seemed as though the police were so desperate to solve the case that they didn't care if he had an alibi or not. In a desperate plea to prove his innocence, Tony voluntarily gave a DNA sample, and even though his overalls had been washed already, he gave those to police too. These items were then sent to the lab. While waiting for the results, Tony said he was continuously harassed by investigators. They showed up to his work, his home, interrogated his family, and with this, people started to see Tony as the person responsible. Then there was 18-year-old Dustin Daly. Dustin was known around town as a troublemaker. He had a history of burglary charges, and even his own family didn't trust him. His mother actually had to get a restraining order against him when he threatened to burn her house down and kill her. So, not really a great guy. And he came into question when he was supposedly bragging to people about his involvement with the girls' deaths. Lastly, there was 19-year-old Mike Gaddy. He was good friends with Dustin and had apparently told police that he was with Dustin at the time of the murders doing some shopping. So he was kind of just pushed into being a suspect by association with Dustin. In September of 2008, these three men were sent to testify in front of a grand jury to tell their side of the story. But ultimately, the grand jury delivered no indictments, and the men were free to go. Later, a Walmart surveillance video would confirm that Dustin and Mike were in the store at the time the girls were murdered. Tony Kilo was also ruled out as a suspect. After that whole mess, leads started to dry up, and police were desperate to try something new. Since they believed the killer or killers were local to the area, they decided to talk to everyone in the area who owned a .40 caliber Glock pistol, as this had been confirmed to be one of the murder weapons. They still had the shell casings from the scene and the actual bullets from the autopsies, so if they could find the gun and make a match, they could find their killer. While police knew that there was a chance the murder weapon wasn't registered, or it probably wasn't likely that the killer would voluntarily step forward, they were more thinking that maybe a teenager had stolen his dad's gun, committed the crime, and the parents had no idea. So that way, the parents would bring in the gun and it would lead them to the killer. But this was small town Oklahoma. It wasn't exactly uncommon to own a gun. In the town of 900 people, almost 60 residents owned a .40 caliber Glock pistol. 40 of these people responded to the police inquiry and voluntarily gave in their gun. These 40 guns were test fired to try and find a match in ballistics, but they all turned up nothing. Then police started to hunt down the people who hadn't responded to their query, one by one. You can imagine, though, hunting down these people and testing firearms took a while. So months later, in 2009, investigators had ruled out almost all of the owners of the pistols, all except previous police officers. Investigators were then tasked with tracking down those officers who had once had a .40 caliber Glock registered in their name. The search brought them back to Officer John Woods, who said that he had sold the gun and its case back in 2007 for $300. He couldn't remember the name of the guy he sold it to, but he said it was a young guy who worked at the local McDonald's. However, this didn't really help much. It was now 2009, so who knew if this guy still worked there, and without a name, they couldn't track this guy down. Also, it may seem strange that a police officer would sell his gun, but apparently in Oklahoma, it's not that uncommon for these kind of exchanges to go down. See, Oklahoma State had this problem where they didn't have enough money to fund government services, and therefore, a lot of the small law enforcement agencies had to pay for things themselves, including their guns. So it makes sense that they may want to sell their gun later and try to make some of their money back. Anyway, like I said, the officer couldn't remember who he had sold it to, and it kind of became a dead end. When the one-year anniversary of the murders rolled around and police still hadn't made an arrest, or even had a suspect, people started to tell each other that the case was going cold. The Placker family had moved to a neighboring county just months after the murder, as they decided living down the road from where Taylor was murdered was just too hard. But the Whitaker family stayed put and refused to even change up Skyla's room. It sat untouched, the same way the 11-year-old girl had left it. Then, months later, in the fall of 2009, detectives on the case got a call from Officer John Woods, the guy who had sold his gun to this mystery man. But it wasn't a mystery anymore. Officer Woods had found the person that he had sold the gun to. He had stopped for lunch at the local Subway sandwich shop and immediately recognized the man behind the counter. It was the guy who used to work at McDonald's, the guy he had given the Glock to. This man's name was Kevin Sweat. 23-year-old Kevin Sweat had grown up in the area with his parents and two brothers. The Sweats were all big hunters, even from a young age. Kevin loved shooting deer and ducks. Maybe because it was one of the only things that he, his brothers, and his dad could bond over. Besides hunting, Kevin didn't do much with his father or brothers. It was described as a strained relationship. He didn't have that many friends either. In high school, Kevin was described as a bit of a loner. He was often the victim of bullying and had been suspended on a few occasions for getting into fights. After dropping out of university, he shifted around various fast food jobs. McDonald's, Subway, KFC. His employers remember him as a good, responsible employee, though a bit strange. He was fascinated by Charles Manson and the mystery of the Green River Killer, whose identity at the time was not known. He listened to heavy metal and he loved to draw, but typically drew darker images. Depressing, violent things. But just a reminder, listening to heavy metal doesn't mean he's a violent person. I mean, just like Kevin, I'm fascinated by serial killers and cult leaders, but I'm not a violent person. Another thing was, though, that Kevin suffered a great deal of tragedy in his life. Around the time Officer John Woods recognized Kevin, Kevin's 13-year-old nephew had been shot and killed. Years earlier, Kevin's older brother had died as a result of a drug overdose. From then on, the Sweat family noticed that Kevin changed. Anyway, back to the story. So we're in the fall of 2009. Officer Woods finally has Kevin Sweat's name. With this, police bring Kevin in to ask about the gun. And they actually knew Kevin, as he had been arrested for possession of marijuana a year earlier. When they asked Kevin about the gun, Kevin told investigators that he had sold it to a friend of his ex-girlfriend's, but he couldn't remember her name. So there wasn't much police could do. Kevin said he didn't remember, and he was in no way a suspect in the two girls' murder. So they thanked him for coming and dismissed him. Okay guys, let's take a quick ad break. And we're back. As the new decade began, leads dried up, but more tragedies followed. Less than 2 years after the murders, a house fire in Waleka killed 6 people. After that, an oil tank explosion killed a youth minister. A year earlier, there had been a massive fire that ripped through downtown, destroying many businesses. People started to think that the town was evil or possessed. 3 years after the murder, Reverend John Overton from the community church said, quote, "I'm telling you, the devil brought devastation to this town," end quote. Many residents believed the small town had been cursed, and it had all started with the murder of Taylor and Skyla. Unfortunately, this so-called curse seemed to continue as the second anniversary of the girls' death passed. Next year, the third anniversary also comes and goes the same way it did the previous 2 years, with no arrests and no promising suspects. While the police worked hard to investigate the case, they still had other cases to work on. Like, new cases came in every day. 3 years had now passed, and they didn't seem to be getting closer to the truth, and the girls' murders were kind of put on the back burner. They were featured in the newspaper on the third anniversary of their murder, but other than that, the media and police moved on to other cases. On July 29, 2010, a woman named Patricia Taylor called the county police department to report her 23-year-old daughter, Ashley, missing. Patricia told investigators that she hadn't heard from her daughter in 2 weeks. Approximately 3 weeks earlier, Ashley had told her mom that she and her fiancé were going on a 2-week road trip to New Orleans, where they were going to elope. Days after that phone call, Patricia tried calling her daughter, but never got an answer. But she assumed that Ashley was probably just enjoying her honeymoon, so she didn't automatically panic. However, when Ashley didn't arrive home like she was supposed to on July 24th, her mother got worried. Patricia also told investigators that she had gone to the apartments where Ashley and her fiancé lived. She found Ashley's fiancé no problem, but he refused to say anything about Ashley's whereabouts. Police agreed that the situation didn't sound too good, and immediately took it seriously, promising Patricia that they would bring the fiancé in for questioning. But then police got a shock, because guess who the fiancé was? Kevin Sweat. So police bring him in and ask him where his fiancé is, and Kevin has an elaborate story. He says that on their road trip, the two had gotten into a huge argument, and Ashley had demanded that Kevin let her out of the car. He then said that he last saw her walking in the direction of her mom's house on Highway 75. And let's say this story is true. Who just kicks their fiancé out of the car on the highway? Ashley's parents, as well as police, aren't buying this story, and do feel like Kevin is covering something up. I mean, he seemed awfully chill that his fiancé had been missing for 2 weeks. Even if they had gotten into an argument, I'd think that you'd still be concerned for her and want her to be found safe. So police went to go interview Kevin's family members, specifically his mom and dad and his aunt. And according to Kevin's family, they had no idea that he and Ashley were planning to get married. They actually said that Kevin had expressed feelings of wanting to break up, whereas Ashley had actually shown her mother her engagement ring. So it's not like this was just some miscommunication. This was Kevin not telling his family what was going on. After hearing this, police were incredibly suspicious that Kevin had something to do with Ashley's disappearance. On August 2nd, 2011, investigators went to find Kevin and ask him a few more questions, and they located him at his mother's house. In this unofficial interview, Kevin again told police that he and Ashley had gotten into an argument and confirmed it was because Kevin didn't want to get married. He then said that after he dropped Ashley on the side of the highway, he went to his dad's house to roast some hot dogs and to kind of just chill out and cool down. Kevin even allowed officers to search his apartment that he shared with Ashley and his car. Ashley's parents had requested police to do this before, but since they didn't have Kevin's permission or a warrant, they couldn't. Now, with Kevin allowing them access, police performed a search on the apartment. Officers recall that the apartment was disgustingly dirty, like literally roaches crawling on the counters. It was noted that Ashley's things were still there. Her clothes, makeup, even her medical prescriptions. Things she would have taken with her if she had left on her own. But what caught their eye was the bottle of bleach and gloves found. Next, they moved on to the car, where they found a collection of knives, various tools, different blades, and a machete. When an officer opened the glove compartment, Ashley's IDs and credit cards came falling out. Then in the trunk, investigators found a 4-foot-long chopping axe. It was bagged for evidence and sent to the lab. Before they concluded, Kevin also voluntarily gave his DNA and fingerprints to police, again without a warrant. And remember, this was just the county police, and they had a pretty small team. So when they searched the apartment and car, it was actually just a few officers. The next day, the county police requested the help of the state police, otherwise known as the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, or OSBI, which is what I'm going to call them. So the county police accompanied the OSBI to the apartment, and immediately upon entering, they realized that everything has been changed around. Things are a bit cleaned up, and items that were previously there are now nowhere to be found. According to the county officers, they were under the impression that when they searched the apartment a day earlier, they were just conducting a wellness check, and therefore they didn't bag anything for evidence from the apartment. I'm not sure why they took things from the car, like they took the axe, but not from the apartment. But either way, they hadn't secured the apartment as a crime scene, and now lots of stuff was missing. The OSBI then conducted a luminol test, which is the chemical compound that will reveal if blood was present, and it came up negative. At this point, they didn't have much. But luckily for police, Kevin was a talker. Later that week, he went in for another interview, And this time, he started to change his story ever so slightly. First, he mentioned that when he had kicked Ashley out of the car, she had accidentally hit her head on the door. He was starting to unravel. The next story was that Ashley then stabbed herself. And by the end of the interview, the story was that Kevin had slit Ashley's throat, dragged her down to the pier, and rolled her off the pier into the lake. Investigators think that this case is finally coming to a close. But when they go to the lake, there is absolutely no evidence that corroborates his story. Like, no blood on the pier, no body in the water. So, this isn't what happened. Police are pretty confident now that Ashley is dead, but they're still struggling to put together the pieces of her last few hours. It's then that Kevin's father comes forward. After learning that his son was a suspect in Ashley's disappearance and possible murder, Curtis Sweat came to police with some startling information. He informed police that on July 17th, Kevin had gone to his property while he was out of town. Kevin's dad was actually kind of annoyed to see that his son had come over and had a fire in his backyard, because in light of the recent Oklahoma wildfires at the time, there was a statewide ban against burning things on your property. So Kevin really risked getting his father a pretty hefty fine. And also, this wasn't a small fire. Curtis said that the charred material left over from the fire measured 5 feet in diameter. When Curtis yelled at his son for having a fire, Kevin claimed that he had just come over to roast some hot dogs. I don't think you need a fire that big to roast hot dogs, but either way, his dad bought it. However, the next day, while Curtis was looking at the fire pit, he found a small ring among the coals. He again asked his son about it, and Kevin said the ring must have fallen out when he was burning trash from his car. This was the final piece that police needed. On August 5th, OSBI began the search in Kevin's father's backyard. Even though the fire had been weeks earlier, it was still obvious where it had once been. Char and coals still sat in a large pile. While some investigators combed through the soot, others searched the area behind the house, where Mr. Sweat had said that his son liked to practice his shooting. Within 10 minutes, a metal detector picked up several shell casings. Among them, 9 shell casings from a .40 caliber Glock pistol. Police knew that Kevin was once a person of interest in the murder of Skyla and Taylor, and that one of the guns that killed those girls was a .40 caliber pistol. So the casings were immediately sent to the forensic center to be analyzed. In the burn pit, investigators found what they suspected to. Fragments of bone, which included hand bone, vertebrae, part of a hip bone, a leg bone, and skull and teeth fragments. Investigators were actually able to recover what would have been about 20% of a human skeleton. To further confirm their suspicions that this was Ashley Taylor, they also found Ashley's eyeglasses, a bra clasp, and her engagement ring. Forensics later confirmed that these were the remains of Ashley Taylor. Forensics was also later confirmed that the blood on the chopping axe was Ashley's. So I guess Kevin murdered her with an axe and not a knife. Kevin Sweat was immediately arrested, and investigators got more warrants to search Kevin's family's properties. They searched his mother's house because that's where Kevin was living at the time of the murder of the two young girls. There, they found more ammunition for a .40 caliber Glock pistol. But not only that, it's the exact same brand as the type found at the 2008 crime scene. Ammunition for a .22 revolver is also recovered in the search. This was what police believe was the second gun used in the shooting. Finally, investigators stumbled upon a case to a .40 caliber Glock. While it was empty, which was disappointing, it did have the serial number on it. So now, they had the serial number to Kevin's missing Glock. When the results come back on the spent shell casings found near the burn pile, it confirmed that these bullets and the bullets from the 2008 shooting of Skyla Whitaker and Taylor Blacker were fired from the same 40 Glock pistol. But just to be devil's advocate, that means they came from the same gun. It doesn't necessarily mean they came from Kevin's gun, though. So they've matched bullet to bullet, but they haven't really matched bullet to gun. So investigators did a little more digging and asked where Officer John Woods had bought the gun. Remember, he was the officer who had sold the Glock to Kevin. When they traced the gun back to John Woods, John told investigators that he'd bought it from another man who had bought it from another police officer. Eventually, the gun was traced back to its first owner, the Baltimore Police Department. So before Kevin, and even before John Woods, the gun belonged to an officer in Baltimore. At the Baltimore Police Department, all guns are required to go through a testing procedure, which involves shooting the gun and then taking that spent shell casing and putting it away with the serial number of the gun. Incredibly, the Baltimore Police Department still had this spent shell casing from their testing over a decade later. When the Baltimore Police Department sent over the serial number, it matched the number of Kevin's gun. Then they compared the two bullets, the one from their testing, and therefore knowing that it was 100% from that gun, and the bullets at the crime scene. They both had the same barrel markings. This proved that not only were all of these bullets fired from the same gun, they were fired from Kevin's. After he was arrested, police confront him with the ballistic evidence, but Kevin denies shooting the two girls. At this point, he has confessed to Ashley's murder, but he's staying firm that he had nothing to do with the murders of Skyla and Taylor. According to Kevin's defense attorney, Kevin denied killing the young girls over 200 times. Police literally just kept asking if he did it, and he kept replying no. But then finally, after many interrogations, on September 13th, 2011, Kevin Sweat confessed to the killings. Kevin said that on June 8th, 2008, he was driving down the county road near where Taylor lived. Then he says he hallucinated two monsters running towards him. Terrified, he pulled out his Glock pistol and shot at one of the monsters. When he ran out of bullets, he reached into his glove box and grabbed his .22 revolver. He fired more shots with this gun. After that, he sped off. And of course, these were the little girls, these were not monsters. In December 2011, he was officially charged with the first-degree murder of Skyla and Taylor. Later that month, the prosecution announced that they would be seeking the death penalty. While they awaited trial, the prosecution got more evidence to build their case. Kevin's cell phone records confirmed that he was in the area of the murders at the time the girls were killed. One of Kevin's co-workers also told police that Kevin was familiar with the Placker family. In fact, he hated the Plackers. One of the Plackers, Christopher Placker, who I believe was Taylor's uncle, had sold drugs to Kevin's brother, the drugs that he would later overdose on. Since then, Kevin had always blamed Christopher Placker for his brother's overdose. So now, the prosecution had a motive. After the murders, Kevin had worked at the same fast food chain as Linda, Taylor's aunt. Linda recalls that Kevin was incredibly interested in the murders. He would always ask her questions about the crime scene. At the time, Linda didn't really think much of it because this was the biggest thing ever to happen in Weleka. So it was all anyone talked about. It didn't really stick out that Kevin was asking questions too. The prosecution also wanted to get proof that Kevin did not suffer from hallucinations, because they wanted to make sure that he couldn't plead insanity. But when they got a forensic psychologist to evaluate Kevin, this psychologist said that he believed Kevin was in fact schizophrenic, and that his hallucinations were possible. So that didn't really help their case. But then the prosecution was hit with a brick wall. Remember that DNA sample police had taken from Sweat? Well, they compared it to the DNA found on the girls' underwear, and it didn't match. Sweat was ruled out as a contributor, Also, just as a note, police did take DNA samples from all of the males at the Placker house, and they were also all ruled out. So now they had the issue of whose DNA was on the girls' underwear. As the trial was to begin on August 4th, 2014, everyone was eager to see what the verdict would be. But then, on July 31st, just days before trial, Kevin pleaded guilty to all three murders, avoiding the death penalty. A week later, he tried to take back his guilty plea, but was told he was not able to. On October 24th, 2014, the day came for Kevin to be sentenced. He was brought into the courtroom, no handcuffs around his wrist. As Kevin's attorney gathered in the front, Kevin all of a sudden lunged at his lawyer, Peter Astor, revealing a small razor blade he had hidden in his sleeve. Other lawyers and security rushed towards Kevin, trying to pull him off of his lawyer, while Kevin managed to cut Peter's throat with the blade. People finally got Kevin off of Peter, who stood clutching his bleeding neck. Fortunately, Peter survived and didn't even require hospitalization. But it was enough for the judge to see what kind of monster Kevin Sweat really was. That day, Kevin was given 3 life terms in prison without the possibility of parole, all to be served consecutively. Following his sentencing, Kevin attempted to appeal his conviction based on the grounds that he wasn't allowed to take back his guilty plea. It was denied. Kevin Sweat is currently serving his time in the Oklahoma State Penitentiary. After he arrived in jail, an extra 60 years was tacked onto the sentence for the attack on his lawyer. He continues to switch up his story every now and then. Some days he claims his innocence. Another time, he told a correctional officer that he had shot his girlfriend and killed her. So, we don't really know how Ashley was killed. At first, he said he slit her throat, then an axe was found with her blood on it, and now he's saying he shot her. And a cause of death couldn't be determined by her charred remains. And as for the semen in the two girls' underwear, I really have no idea. Some have suggested that maybe the older girl, Taylor, was sexually active, and then maybe the two girls had shared underwear, and that's how semen was on both. But that seems pretty far-fetched to me, and I don't like how the judge and the lawyers kind of just accepted this. There needs to be a better explanation, or at least prove that that's the case. Either way, though, Kevin Sweat is where he belongs. I'm not sure what the Whitakers and Plackers think about the DNA on the girls' underwear, but they do believe Kevin Sweat was the man responsible for the shootings. But what do you guys think? Was there another person involved? How did the DNA not match Kevin? I would love to hear your opinion, because honestly I'm stumped. But there you have it, a huge, confusing case that still doesn't really have all the missing pieces. Thanks for tuning in for another episode, and if you want these episodes ad-free, or maybe want more episodes, you can check out our Patreon, and I'll put the link in the show notes. You can also follow the podcast on social media to see any kind of updates, and also photos of the cases that I cover. As always, keep supporting indie podcasts, and stay safe out there.